Welcome to Changing Academic Life. I'm Geraldine Fitzpatrick, and this is a podcast series where academics and others share their stories, provide ideas, and provoke discussions about what we can do individually and collectively to change academic life for the better.
Have you ever had the experience of stepping into some sort of leadership role? Whether it's even just starting to supervise students, or maybe it's setting up your own lab, or being a principal investigator on your project, and feeling like you've been totally unprepared for this role, despite all the training that you've received so far about how to be a scientist and how to be a researcher. That was the experience of my guest today, Professor Jen Heemstra, and also I have to say my experience as well, as I'm sure for many of you. Jen is a biomolecular engineer, and she's worked for 15 years as a principal investigator, and she's now the Charles Allen Thomas Professor and Chair of the Department of Chemistry at Washington University in St. Louis in the US. Jen has actually been on my list of people that I've wanted to talk to from way back in the early days when there was Twitter as a good thing. And I absolutely had to talk to her now after I read the book that she just published, called Lab Work to Leadership, A Concise Guide to Thriving in the Science Job You Weren't Trained For. And I cannot recommend this book highly enough. It's made up of three sections, self-leadership, leading others, and coaching future leaders. And we touch on all of these themes at different points in the conversation. As in the book, Jen shares lots of her personal stories with such generosity and honesty, and also shares what she's distilled from the literature and her experiences interpreted specifically to our academic contexts. There are so many insights here, as well as practical strategies for how we can foster and develop better leadership skills, grow better group cultures, and really help develop the future leaders within our academic settings. It's a great follow-on episode too from my previous conversation with Jane Price, where Jane also talked about leadership and culture. So I really hope you enjoy this episode with Jen Heemstra. Jen, I'm really excited to have this conversation with you. So thank you for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to have the chance to talk with you.
I remember following you on Twitter years ago when I was on Twitter.
I still call it Twitter too.
When it was a nice place to be.
Yeah.
And you were always so wise and real. And what I'm really excited about is that you've put a lot of this wisdom about being an academic and doing it with kindness and how to create great workplaces into a book called Lab Work to Leadership, A Concise Guide to Thriving in the Science Job You Weren't Trained For, which is, of course, the case, isn't it, that we're never trained for it?
We're totally not trained for it. And, you know, I hadn't put two and two together until you just said that, but I started thinking about the book a little bit before Twitter started to go downhill. But I didn't quite realize how perfect it would be that as that one outlet, you know, dried up or turned into kind of the raging dumpster fire that it is, that I would have this other outlet with trying to finish the book and then getting to talk to wonderful people like you about it in place of being on Twitter and getting to have that outlet to share things.
Because I think one of the things that a lot of those Twitter posts and conversations did was to give voice to ways of being in academia that we often didn't hear about before. Where did they come from for you? Like, what's your background?
Yeah, well, I got into science and specifically into chemistry a little bit by accident. So I like to think that I'm in some ways a sort of odd person to be a scientist, or I don't necessarily fit the mold. But that being said, I think that there's actually a lot of us out there who don't necessarily fit the mold. I would guess that you would say the same thing.
I definitely do say the same thing.
Yeah, that right. And, you know, we're now at a place where there's enough conversation that there's space to say, oh, wait, no, I don't quite fit that mold of someone who's a deep, deep introvert who just wants to be down in their basement lab working over their instrument all day long. You know, I love being in lab. I love doing research. I also really enjoy talking with people. I enjoy sharing about my emotions. I enjoy
people focused on my job. With emotions.
That's basically what Twitter boils down to for me. There was a moment when I learned about Twitter and I had also gone through a really, really disruptive career experience with almost not getting tenure at my initial institution.
Wow.
And just this confluence of factors of I came out of that experience really fired up and fearless and with a whole lot of drive to stop obeying the, you know, quote unquote rules that I had been given for how to be a professor and to start doing my job according to my values and what seemed best to me. And I was really outspoken because I had gone through this difficult situation and my lab and I had thrived through that. And then I found out about Twitter and started seeing what people were talking about on there and just realized, oh, wow, there's this conversation starting to happen around all of the people side of our job and not just how we do good research, but how we be great mentors and how we help others develop as future leaders. And I'll say for me, it was, I feel like I got way more from that community than I ever gave. I learned so much from other things that people were saying. I learned so much from the opportunity to have conversations around these topics. I made so many wonderful connections and friends through that. It was just a really fun and rich time.
And I'm hoping that it has given people more permission to have those conversations every day in their labs, in their day-to-day life, because that's where people doing the research.
Right. Yeah, I feel like there is more of that. I mean, and your podcast is having a huge impact in that. The way that you are opening up and inviting other people in to open up about these more personal stories in science, it's giving people space to be their full human selves as scientists, to not just be these researchers who run experiments and publish papers, but to be people who have self-doubt or who have really wonderful days or really challenging days or whose personal lives intersect with their professional path in ways that they didn't expect. And just to think much more about that side where we're all humans. We don't have to be these robots who just answer our email and work for 14 hours a day or whatever it is that picture that was given to us.
And the role of leaders in creating space for that as well. I'm going to come to some of those sorts of discussions, but you talked about coming out of traumatic tenure experience. And in your book, I think you described it as among the worst experience of your life. What values did you come out of that with that you could really articulate from that?
Thanks for that question. I do. I like to say that it was the worst day of my life. It still was to this day. And I've had some, you know, less people think, wow, she's just had an easy life. It's like, no, I grew up in a difficult home, dealt with, you know, almost taking my own life as a high schooler because it was so bad. I've now lost both parents. But what made that the worst day of my life is that so many people had trusted me to be successful in this academic career, that my family had moved across the country for me to take that job. My partner, my spouse, had said, hey, wherever you go, I will find a job there and we will set where we're going to live based on your job because we are all in on you getting tenure and all of the things that would bring to our family, to our kids, for our future. So all of my family was counting on me. And then my lab, that when you're an assistant professor, it is such a humbling experience and such an honor that students and postdocs would join your lab and put their trust in saying, hey, I'm going to bet my career on our lab that we're going to make it and we're going to do great research and that I'm going to keep having a place to do that research because we'll get tenure and that this group will exist into the future to be one that I continue to have on my CV as being from. And so I took all of that responsibility so seriously and felt like all of these people were counting on me to be successful in getting tenure. And then when I had a negative vote, you know, it was a 50-50 vote. And of course, you know this, and probably many of your listeners know this, but I always say to people who aren't familiar with academia, you know, it's not like running for president where you just need to get the majority of the vote. It's like passing a class where 50% is an F and you failed. You really need like an 80% or something like that to pass. And so on that day, I had to sit in this space of thinking, wow, I have failed. And somehow I thought things were going well. Everyone told me things were going well, but I must have missed the signs. Someone must have been trying to tell me that this wasn't going well. And I could have seen this if I had been paying attention. And because I was just having so much fun in this job that I never thought I could have, and then I had it, it was incredible. I was just too busy having fun living this life of, you know, empowering my lab and doing research that I loved and being in this place I loved, that I missed the signs. And because I missed it, I have now blown it for all the people I care about the most in this world. I've blown it for my family, blown it for my research group, all of these people I care about who were counting on me, and I've messed it up and let them down. And that is what made it the worst day of my life, because I have never felt that low before or at any other time, right? That it was my fault that things were bad.
That's a lot of responsibility to carry.
And I don't know any other way about it, though. When people don't feel that responsibility, then they don't necessarily invest or take the job as seriously. But yet we can't beat ourselves up. It also just changed me. My group showed up. They found out what had happened. I did eventually get tenure. I had some really, really amazing leaders who stuck up for me and said, this shouldn't have happened. We're going to fix it. And that's actually what inspired me to want to go on to a career in leadership myself. I didn't realize it then, but that really set me on a path to being a department chair now. But also my group showed up. And when I told them, I went, you know, I called my spouse, told him, next stop was to tell my group. And their response changed me forever. They looked at me, they were angry. They had a lot of words to say, not at me, but at the institution, at what had happened. And they said, look, we know the quality of work we've done. We know how great our group is. And we know that we're going to get tenure somewhere. It was so personal because we all had ownership over the program we created. Mm-hmm. And they said, we know we're going to get tenure somewhere, whether it's here or somewhere else. And as long as we get to keep doing this research, we'll go wherever you go. And that was so humbling to have my lab, my group, my colleagues respond in that way. It really changed me. And I think coming out of it, I thought, oh my goodness, I felt like I was playing by the rules of the faculty around me. And many of them were extremely, extremely supportive. But at the same time, I thought, wow, I felt like I was playing by those rules. And a lot of good that did me. So now going forward, I'm just going to play by my own values. I'm going to do this job according to my own values. I'm not going to try to conform to the system. It's going to be about me and my lab. People in my lab are my colleagues. They come first. We are all in this together as a team. And it's kind of that like us against the world sort of feeling.
Yeah.
But it really refocused, recentered my values and got me thinking about all of these things that could be better in academia. And so it ended up, we had this super low time. And then over the next 6 months, we already had quite a good amount of funding. And then we got 6 more grants over the next 6 months or so. So we were like popping champagne. I had to like remind people. They were like, I feel like we're just drinking champagne every month. And like, which grant is this again? And so we had, and then we got recruited away. And so we had this really, really dark time and then just thrived out of it. And it just left me feeling completely unstoppable and fired up and ready to, you know, think differently about things, ready to tackle academic culture. And I will say that's where Twitter and the community was such a gift, because I was in this moment. And then to find that community of like-minded people who were thinking about the same things, advocating for the same things, and to be able to be part of that movement and that conversation was just such an incredible gift.
When you were talking about taking on that really strong sense of responsibility for the people in the lab, and I love the we language, and I love the fact that the language that they used was, I bet my career on your lab. I'd never thought about the people who choose to take up your PhD positions or postdoc positions as betting their career on you and your lab, but they do. Did you think of yourself as a leader then? Like, when did you start thinking of yourself as a leader?
That's a wonderful question. It was a bit of a slow process, I would say. There were definitely the jarring moments, like when I opened the book with having this day where I realized that I had this job that I wasn't trained for, and I had to learn these leadership skills that I hadn't necessarily received formal training in, and how important those were for my job. And then that created a slow evolution of realizing, oh, wow, yes, I am. I think there was always a sense of, you know, from day one, I remember standing in my empty lab space on my first day as a faculty member and looking around and thinking, okay, here we are at time zero. And 5 years in the future, that endpoint, I can picture what that needs to look like. It looks like this lab being full of people and equipment, and research is happening, and papers have been published, and funding has been gotten. And thinking how we get from point A to point B is this sort of grand challenge. It was very, very intimidating. It was also really exhilarating. And I think I did have a sense of, this will require me to have leadership skills, right? I tell new faculty, I'm like, look, my first group meeting was unbelievably awkward. I think I got up in front of the two or three people who had gathered by that point and said, here's what I would like our group meetings to look like for now. And here's why we're doing this. And I will demonstrate the presentation style that we will use for our group meetings by sharing my own experiment. It was terrible. But I think I had this sense of, okay, I am the person who's leading this team through all of this. But I didn't realize, I think I knew that I needed to be a leader, but I had very little idea about just how broad of a topic it is and how many skills and intention, how much intentionality goes into being the leader who you want to be.
Yeah. And how do you find out who do you want to be as a leader? It sounds like in standing up in that first meeting saying, this is the way we're going to run the meeting, and this is the presentation style, you'd taken on that responsibility as well, very much of, if I'm the leader, it's my responsibility.
Yeah. I need to do this. So often, though, it was so awkward. I remember just coming out of that and being like, wow, this was so painful.
But they stayed.
And I did have a sense of, yes, it will be awkward to get this up and rolling. But then I thought, okay, I've been in labs. I see what this looks like once the people in the lab take over that culture and once they're the ones driving it. And it's not just me having to drive what our lab is going to look like. And so very quickly, I mean, it took all of a couple of weeks before the members of my lab, my colleagues in the lab, were really taking over and driving, and they were mentoring and they were commenting on other people's work.
Just a couple of weeks that happened.
It happened pretty quickly.
Wow.
And that's in part because I just had and have had over all of these years phenomenal colleagues in the lab. That the people who joined came in and said, okay, we're all in. this is what we're doing. We're going to launch this lab. We're going to make this happen. This is who we're going to be as a group. We're going to push each other to do great science. We're going to create this collegial, fun environment. Now, mind you, I didn't have the leadership skills to actually know how to create the group culture that I wanted to have. I thought if I just, you know, said it often enough what I wanted our culture to be, that it would be that. And it turns out that that did not happen. And that over time I learned, oh, you need to put systems in place that make this happen. And we have to have difficult conversations. And it takes all of these really intentional things to create that culture. And it's never perfect, right? That culture is something you need to constantly work on and maintain. And we will continually make mistakes and we need to keep evolving and all of those things. I didn't realize what it would take, but I knew what I wanted because I had come from very, very healthy labs. I like to say, you know, I wasn't prepared to be a leader, but that wasn't any deficit of my own mentors. It was a deficit of the system that just didn't value that. So I was very lucky in that I had phenomenal mentors. My undergrad lab, my PhD lab, my postdoc lab, all of those were just really healthy labs with really fantastic mentors. And so I knew what I wanted things to look like. I just didn't necessarily know how to create that.
Because it's interesting when you said that first day when you stood in the space and imagined ahead, you talked about it in terms of what the system requires in the ticks, in terms of the grants and the papers, not how it felt. But you clearly also, in standing there, a sense of what you wanted it to feel like for people.
Yes, I did. And
or rather, I should have asked that as a question.
I like, did I? Yeah, I think I knew certain values that I wanted my lab environment to have. And I knew certain aspects of the experience that I wanted people to have in the lab. But I didn't know how to create that. It's like saying, oh, I want to have this garden that looks this certain. I'm a terrible gardener, so maybe this is a really, really terrible example. I killed a lot of houseplants. But it's like saying, I want to have this garden that looks a certain way, but not knowing, you know, what fertilizer you need to put on the soil and when you need to plant and how much water you have to give it. So I had this vision, but I hadn't yet developed the skills to create that. But then thankfully, I realized somewhere along the way that I wasn't alone. I had this experience of realizing that conflict resolution was like part of my job and needing to mediate this conflict and feeling completely unprepared for that. And then that started to get me realizing that, oh yeah, there are all of these leadership skills out there. There's books, there's articles, there's all of these things, but that we don't necessarily, the system doesn't integrate those into our training. But the really fun thing about that is then when I would go traveling around giving seminars other places, when I'd be talking with other faculty, you know, the ones who I could tell cared about leadership as well, I kind of say like, hey, so like I've had this experience where I realized like there's all these skills I need and like nobody, you know, the system didn't really train me with these. Have you felt that as well? And universally people were like, oh my goodness, yes, that's a huge challenge. And I feel that too, right? No one told me I'd be my own HR manager and my own finance manager and my own advertising division and all of these things. And so it was a struggle to then say, okay, well, you know, there's these skills I need to learn, but it was also really community building. And immediately I realized I wasn't alone in this and that this was a really common theme for a lot of us out in academic science.
Mm. Yeah. Your book is in three sections, and the middle section is about leading others. And what is interesting there is you start off talking about it should be a team sport, you know, like running a lab and that it's a team sport. So if you think back to that first meeting and the skills that you're aware of now and what you've learned, if you were going back in time, what do you think you'd do differently at that meeting?
That is a wonderful question. I don't think I've ever thought about that before. I think rather than coming in and saying, here's how our lab will run, here's what our culture will be, here's how we're going to achieve that, I would have instead come in and just opened the conversation of, how do we want to do science? How are we going to treat each other? How can we best work together? How can we, you know, both the culture aspects of how will we treat each other? What will this lab look like? How will it feel to walk into this lab every day? But also the strategy of how will we succeed? What types of meetings do we need to have? How can we use this time effectively to support everyone's success? And I actually got there years later. One of the really eye-opening moments, and I can't remember if I share this in the book, but it was talking with my friend Troy Champ, who is in the book. There's a few quotes from him that really stuck with me and shaped me as a leader. But I was having a conversation with him about 4 or 5 years in. Actually, I remember it was 7 years in because I was about to move. It was like our last conversation before I moved to Atlanta with my lab. And we had just come out of our lab retreat, and I had read Creativity, Inc. and gotten really excited about like the culture of candor and how do you create candor and how can that advance creativity? And I'm talking on, I'm like, oh my goodness, you know, we're doing this, we're doing that. And like, you know, I think that's really rare for academic labs and this is this new thing. And he looks at me and so kindly, he says, Jen, that's just organizational leadership. I was like, oh. It's like, yes, there's this whole field out there. But I think at the time, there was at least in, you know, the conversations I was having within academia, faculty weren't sitting down and saying, hey, I listened to this organizational leadership podcast and let's talk about it, right? That just wasn't happening. But it made me realize, oh, yes, there is this whole field of scholarship out there. And people who do nothing but study this and write about it and podcast about it. And that was such an eye-opening moment for me. And then a few years later, I was having a conversation with him and said, you know, I think I want to do an exercise with my lab where we figure out what are our values and really elaborate and articulate what is the culture we want to have. And I'm thinking of doing it this way. He was like, no. He's like, okay, you think you want to do that and that'll get you something. But what you really want to do is go read this book and generate this whole playbook of not only your values, but also your strategy. What are your strategic pillars? How are the ways that your lab does things? What is your, you know, big vision? What is your one-year goal? And how are you going to make that happen? And then we took time at one of our retreats and walked through all of that. And then that was a really, really wonderful exercise and got us to really changed how we do a lot of things in our lab. And so in theory, if I had known about that back at my first group meeting, we would have done more of that. But at the same time, I don't know that as a team, we would have been necessarily ready for that. So maybe there also was a place for in that first year, just like, you know, the sorts of problems we were having, it wasn't like, how do we think about interdisciplinary collaboration in our lab? It was like, where are we going to put all the round bottom flasks and who's going to have what bench and how are we going to use our budget for our startup and which HPLC are we going to buy? So maybe I need to give myself some grace too that I wouldn't have done it all that differently.
But it is interesting, the conversation, because doing all of that practical logistical stuff as part of setting up and ramping up and getting to know one another and those explicit discussions about who are we, how do we want to work together, as well as the sort of more strategic vision and stuff, they're important to do.
Yeah, it's really, both are really important. Something I'm reflecting a bit on though as we have the conversation is that I do think that for anyone who's starting a new team or a new role, and this isn't just new faculty, but I think also about myself, moving institutions, becoming a new department chair, it's important to have those conversations there's also, I would argue, or at least in the ways that I've seen it, it's really important not to just come in and have the conversation, but in those early days and months, even more important to just model that behavior yourself. And so maybe in some ways too, if we had sat down at a group meeting, the conversation would have just been hollow about what sort of culture are we going to have if we hadn't already been showing up and modeling that and showing that we really, really meant it.
Yeah. That theme of modeling the behavior and being real about the fact that you have your good and bad days and that is a really strong thread through the whole book, and especially the first section of the book about self-leadership, which is where it starts, isn't it?
It is. Yes. And I appreciate the people who have told me that, because I had a little bit of a back and forth with my publisher at some point about whether that was important. And I remember thinking, well, leadership is such a lonely place. Mm. And in academia, I feel like in a lot of places, when you're a leader, there's almost always a leader above you, right? In industry, you go and you have a boss, and your boss has a boss, and your boss's boss has a boss. Mm. And so there's someone who's giving you feedback on your leadership. And now I think self-leadership is important for all leaders, but especially in academia, where part of what drew me into this job is I'm really bad at having a boss. I think most of us probably have a real independent sort of streak. Yeah, we want the autonomy. We don't want someone micromanaging our day-to-day. But then that means that self-leadership is incredibly important, because there aren't really, unless something is going very, very poorly, right? Nobody's going to stop on by and say like, oh, how you ran that group meeting could have been better. Or I saw your strategic plan for this year and I think you're missing some things. There's none of that. So we have to do that for ourselves.
How do you think about self, because self-awareness versus self-leadership, or self-reflection versus self-leadership, because that choice of self-leadership seems very deliberate. So what shifts it from just awareness and reflection to leadership?
That is so interesting. I'd be curious what you think about this as well. I would say that self-awareness is arguably a requirement for effective self-leadership, because if you're not able to assess yourself and try to understand what's making you feel a certain way, or what's driving you to do a certain thing, or why you're motivated for this versus that, then getting the self-leadership piece right is extremely difficult.
Yeah.
But maybe it's, you know, self-leadership is when you take all of that self-awareness and then you put a strategy into it to turn it into action of showing up as a good leader to yourself. But I will say that I'm going to reflect on this, because I had a really great call with my coach yesterday, that we should give ourselves a lot of grace on the self-awareness, because we're not always going to get there ourselves, that we all need people who can reflect it. And, you know, I was talking with my coach about, why am I feeling so overwhelmed in certain situations right now? You know, like when my email piles up, I feel much more overwhelmed than I used to. And I was going through like, oh, I think it's because of this or because of that. And my coach said, well, I think it's because of this. And I was like, oh, you are totally right. I had not been thinking of it that way, but her kind of knowing what's been in my life the last few months, she was spot on with what a huge part of it was. And so now I think we don't want to set this expectation that we can always have enough self-awareness to just get there ourselves.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, that in partnership with having people in our lives, mentors, colleagues, coaches, where we can talk through these things together, but it's taking that initiative to go have those conversations and to not just be like, well, I'm getting overwhelmed and then I'm being frustrated with everyone around me, or coming home in a really bad mood to my family. I think the self-leadership piece isn't always figuring out the answer, but saying, okay, I do need to figure this out. This is not leading me to be my best self. And I need to figure out what's going on here so that I can work on it.
Yeah. And there's a lovely chapter around receiving feedback that seems to fit in really nicely to that point.
Whoops, thanks, Zach. So what do you think about self-awareness and self-leadership?
It just occurred to me in seeing the self-leadership title and I thought, oh, it's interesting that it's not self-awareness. And I guess we also talk about self-leadership, but I'd never really thought about it. And yeah, I agree that the awareness is like a necessary precondition for the leadership, but the leadership part is having the guts to do something about it, you know, and in the intentionality piece that you said, because you said earlier about being the sort of leader that I want to be, and that requires also some thinking and reflection about who do I want to be and how do I want to show up? Where am I at right now, like the self-awareness piece, and how can I show up better or how can I better support or how can whatever? And that takes a lot of bravery, I think. And in the receiving feedback section of the book, the thing about going and asking people, because we can all think we're doing a great job, but actually the people that we're working with are the ones who can really reflect it back to us. And also someone like, as you said, your coach, who can just sit a little bit more objectively as a different sort of role. Do you want to say anything about the working with the people in your lab to get that feedback or to help that awareness and change process?
Well, I love your quote about the self-leadership is having the guts to do something about it. I'm going to hold on to that one and just, you know, every day I'd be like, when I think of something that needs to be better, I'd be like, okay, are you going to have the guts to do something about it today? So thank you for that. That will stay with me for a long time. And then on the feedback, you know, I will say that that was one of the more difficult leadership situations I've been in, and really on both sides of it, that receiving feedback and figuring out how to address it, both how to talk to my research group about it, and then also how to address it in practical terms to actually make the changes that I want to make. Those were both really, really difficult. But one of the even more difficult things for me personally was learning how to give feedback. And I am still growing in this, because I'm such a conflict-averse person, and so I feel really uncomfortable giving feedback. And I'm someone where I'm already pushing myself so hard. I'm like pedal to the metal. So when someone tells me I need to do something better, I'm almost like, I give up. That's it. I was given 110%, and I don't have any more. So if that's not good enough, we're done here, and I give up. But realizing that not everyone in my lab, some people in my lab are like that as well. And I need to think about that. You know, I almost never give them feedback to tell them to do something differently or better. You know, you're just trying to pull pressure off of those individuals and assure them, help them be kinder to themselves.
Yeah.
But that other people in the lab wanted really candid feedback. I remember a time that someone in the lab was trying to get a paper written. And they said, okay, what I need you to do is on Monday morning, ask me what writing I'm going to get done this week. And then you need to look at me and say, okay, I'm going to show up Friday afternoon and you better have gotten this done. I'm going to ask you what you've gotten done. And I'm just horrified thinking if someone did that to me, I would just be a mess. I'd be a mess all week. I'd be like, that's it. I'm going home and like, you know, sleeping on the couch all week. I can't do this. But for that person, That was how they worked well. That was what they wanted. And that was great, brilliant self-leadership from that individual to say, this is what I need and here's how I'm going to work well and here's how you can coach me well, and realizing that I needed to learn how to do that. In fact, one of the really interesting meta things is that one of the topics I've gotten the most feedback from my lab on is how I give feedback to them. And how I balance that sort of candor and accountability versus flexibility and accommodating that things don't always go right, but also creating a lot of accountability and how, you know, to what extent do I share if something doesn't seem quite right? And so, but that's been hard because I'm like, this doesn't come naturally to me.
Yeah. I feel with you on that one because it's not an easy thing and it's really hard to get confused, you know, that thing about being kind and being nice. And sometimes nice isn't kind, actually. Kind is being brave enough to have the hard conversation with people. And what you said there assumes that you understand the people that you're working with, that you've got to know them and that this is what this person needs and that this is what another person needs. How do you do that?
I mean, that we both know, right? That is one of the toughest things about leadership and mentoring is that every single person is different.
Everyone.
And none of them is us.
Yeah.
And, you know, just trying to figure out what works. You know, I think about motivation, right? That you're trying to get for everyone to be their best. And that's not just productivity, but to be the healthiest that they can be in the lab. There's some like happy medium and of amount of pressure that they might feel, that there's some urgency, but not so much that it's overwhelming. And because we all want to feel like we're growing and performing well and doing good work, you know, that's a fairly common thing. And some people are already putting so much pressure on themselves that they're almost counterproductive. And so you can just come in and pull back, say like, don't worry about it. You can miss that deadline. It's okay that you didn't get that experiment done today, or it's okay that it didn't go perfectly the first time. And there's other people where you have to do what that person asked me of like, hey, you better have gotten these 1,000 words written by Friday or I'm going to be very disappointed or whatever. And you're trying to get everyone to this happy medium. But what that requires for each person is different. And then that's just one of, you know, really an infinite number of different sort of traits or aspects of work where you're trying to accommodate and you're trying to help someone come in and be a support to someone to help them be their best. Something we've done in the lab that's actually been really fun is actually two things. One is we did a personality inventory. So I mentioned the Berkman in the book. And when I was at Emory, their HR actually had a contract or whatever with them. So we could, through the university, we could pay to do that and have someone come in and facilitate the whole debrief with us for a couple of hours. And we all did that together. And then that was fascinating and incredibly powerful. And then we spent a few weeks digging into, okay, well, what does each person's inventory say about them? And what does this say about how we work best and how we can most effectively work together? How can we support each other? How can we avoid conflicts? Things like that. And then out of that, I started asking people, like, how can I coach you best? You know, we've got some big goals this year. How can I best help you achieve those goals? What are the things that I can do? And that takes some self-awareness for all of us. I don't always know the things that I need, but to at least a first approximation, it's just fascinating.
That's a great question to ask people. And it's such a respectful question as well.
But no one trains us to do this.
Need? And also that weight of responsibility that you carry into that first meeting. Takes it off a little bit and makes it more of the we. How can I support you? And if you don't have any ideas, I can offer some suggestions, but it's that conversation. And you talk in the book also about the importance of psychological safety and building trust, and that's come up quite often in discussions. That building trust piece seems to be a really important part of the whole dance.
It really is. And as you were talking about psychological safety, asking people what they need, something that all of this really gets at is that the traditional way of thinking about a group in academia, not that everyone has always done this, but at least the traditional way is like, oh, the PI is like the boss and everyone else reports to them. And there's this very real power structure no matter what you do. I feel like I just spend my days trying to tear down power structure. But there's this way of thinking of like, oh, faculty up here and students and postdocs down here. And not only do I just think that it doesn't align with my values or ethics at all, because I say, no, we are all equally valuable because we are all human beings. We are all colleagues. We just have different job duties. And some of those are reporting. You know, I have a boss. I have a dean who I report to his chair. But we're still all human beings, right? And I think that when the choice is made to run a lab in that traditional sort of way, all of this is what we lose. And that when we choose to run a lab by saying, hey, we are all colleagues, we're all on the same team, we are all equally valuable, we have different jobs, but we're going to treat each other with dignity and respect. And I don't always get that perfectly, but this is what we're going to aim to do. And we're going to look at it from this stance of we are all in this together. Then that fosters those interactions where you can have those conversations and where you can build trust. And it still takes constant maintenance and you're never going to get it right. You know, I always tell people, sorry, I'm going to back up. There was a time when we had a grant that was extremely, extremely important. We're trying to get tenure. We needed to hit certain metrics to hold on to this grant. And it all felt very high pressure. I was under a lot of pressure. The team that was working on that project was under a lot of pressure. And I will never forget that one of the members of the group, one of my colleagues, such good leadership. This person is a phenomenal leader, such good emotional intelligence, came to me and found a very kind way to say, you know, Jen, we all know how important this is. We are doing our best. And you putting more pressure on us is not actually helping us achieve these goals. And I remember saying, okay, you are totally right. And I am so, so sorry that I have been doing that. I have been letting the pressure I feel. One of my jobs should be to feel all that pressure and then kind of filter that out, you know, protect you, be an umbrella to protect you from that, not to just let it all pour down on you. And I've been feeling it that. But what I said is, okay, you are totally right, and I'm so sorry. And here's the deal. Obviously, this is a high-pressure situation. I'm going to do my best, and I want you to help me. I promise that I am going to remind myself of that, and I'm going to work to shield you from this pressure. And what I want you to promise me is that when I don't get that right, and when I'm putting too much pressure on it, it's not helpful, you look at me and go, Jen, we understand how important this is. Back the heck off and let us do our work. And this person looked at me like, I would never say that to you. I'm like, well, you can say that or you can say it in a kinder way. But like, you have this much latitude to be this candid so that hopefully I'll get this much actual, you know, if I give you this much space,
yes, yeah,
hopefully you'll use at least this much space and now come to me and be like, you know, we get this, back off. You're putting on too much pressure. But I found a lot of power in that hyperbole of saying, wow, you know, you can say this to me and I won't be offended. And so if you have that much space, you know, find anything within that that works for you.
That says a lot in the very beginning, though, about the culture that you'd created and the trust that you'd already built up. That someone was prepared to come and say, hey, wait a minute, you're putting too much pressure on. That says
well, thank you. I will just say that that individual was such an outstanding, is such an outstanding leader and someone who I still enjoy talking to this day and have so much respect for as a leader and colleague now.
But they still have to say it. And that would have been an uncomfortable conversation, like having to take a deep breath. And it role models as well what you've just shared there. Your definition of a great leader, and I'm going to start using this as well. Great leaders aren't people who never make mistakes. They are people who can learn from them. And that just is so freeing.
Yeah, we don't have to get it perfectly.
We don't, yeah. And you also role model that thing that's the third section of the book. It's around coaching future leaders, which is, how do we move from role modeling, which you talked about earlier, to actually teaching people? And even that small act of saying, this is the permission you have to give me feedback, is teaching them ways of stepping up and saying what their needs are and giving feedback. I'm conscious of time here. Is there anything you want to say around coaching future leaders to build on that sort of story? Because I think that's really powerful. Like, the whole premise of the book is that no one taught you how to do it, and you did absorb some of the things that you wanted to achieve in that, having been in good labs, but the how to achieve it or how to do it, you didn't know, and they were the skills you needed to learn. So what are some practical tips for people about how they might grow those skills in other people in their labs or their departments?
Thanks so much for that question. I will say that that section of the book was what made me realize I want to write this book. I started out, I didn't think I could ever write a book. I wasn't entirely sure I wanted to. And I gave myself a year just to outline. I said, look, no pressure this year. The only thing I'm on the hook for is to open a Word doc. And whenever I have a thought, I will put it into this document and see what happens, see what I come up with. And it was when I started to look at all of the topics and realized that there could be this arc from self-leadership to leading others, but then to developing future leaders. You know, there's certainly books out there on this. I think of like Multipliers is a really great one that you talk about how to help people be their best, but that there isn't as much on those topics that's really well suited to academia, and that we do sit in this really unique place in how the types of leadership jobs we have. I mean, one of my leadership friends, I say, you know, hey, you run this team that you might work with for 10 or 20 years. Some of them might be with you your whole careers you spend together. I said, I lead a team where almost nobody will stay more than 5 years, and the median age will always be something like 26, right? You know, there's people from all different stages of their life who come in and work in a lab. But when you run a lab of primarily undergrads, grad students, and postdocs, almost everyone, you know, the minute they join, their goal, success for them, looks like leaving your team. And that's not how it works so much out there in the rest of the leadership world. And so because of that, we have this opportunity to help people right now learn all of those skills, you know, kind of that sense of like, wait, the system didn't give me these skills. Well, we can change that system. You know, we are the system, and we can help students and postdocs develop those skills now. So then when, wherever they go, whether they go to academia or whether they go to industry or government, they're ready to negotiate a difficult conflict or to do a strategic visioning exercise or to give and receive feedback. And I struggled a bit to write that section, though, because so much of it was like, well, just like teach them everything you know, or talk openly about the things you're struggling with and how you approach situations. It's just how we model and teach things on a practical level. Actually, this is a really fun day to say this because yesterday was the first day of our semester. And so today is the first day of my class. And I teach a class now for our first year graduate students that is focused on a lot of these skills. So we're going to talk about goal setting and coping with failure and negotiation and conflict resolution and communication and project management and how to develop research ideas, some really practical things, how to write.
Yeah.
And then we also hit on a lot of these, you know, how to be an ethical leader, how to be a change maker. We hit on a lot of those leadership skills because it's a chance to learn those together. And so I think a lot of it doesn't have to be overly complicated. Our lab, one of the most high value but low investment, low work things we do is we get together for a lunch meeting. People can bring their lunch or snack or whatever, or not, bottle of water. But we reserve a conference room 1 hour each month. We have a lunch. We either work through a book together, or right now we just, every time we choose a podcast or a video, you know, 20 minutes in length, and everyone listens to it on their morning drive or their run or while they're working in lab. And then we just get together and talk about it. And we grow our leadership skills through doing that. So I think it doesn't have to be complicated. But again, it takes that intentionality of, instead of just diving in and being a leader to actually talk about that little bit of that behind the scenes of the act of leadership and to talk about our doubts and our struggles and also the high moments, the good moments.
Say the successes as well.
Yeah. I feel like there's a part of academic culture where that's changed quite a lot, but we can kind of be champion complainers, can't we? And some of that is camaraderie of like, oh my goodness, how many emails did I get today? Or, you know, how many meetings do I have? But we also need to share the positive things about this job more often. And not that every person in our lab, you know, most of the people in our labs probably should not be continuing on into this job. If our only goal is self-replication, we are totally failing, right? That they should be going all sorts of places. But we need to show that this job is feasible, that it, you know, why we're in it. We're in it because we find it rewarding. Something is keeping us here and why we're here and not elsewhere. And also something, because I'm such a sort of odd fit for academia in many ways, I often say as well, like, hey, the way I do this job does not have to be the way other people. Like, if you're thinking of academia, but you look at how I do this, you don't have to do it like that. I am the odd one here. And yes, you can absolutely be that person who, you know, just loves being in your lab with your instrument and working with other people and teaching them how to use that. You don't have to want to write a book or do podcasts or be on social media or even do a lab retreat or these other things. You can find a way to do this. Any job, you can find a way to do in a way that's authentic to you.
Yeah. Lovely. Anything in particular that you'd want to say that we haven't talked about?
I can't think of it, though. I almost want to have like a whole other conversation about like the whole journey to having a family or not having a family. And, you know, just all of that is. So maybe we'll get to meet up sometime or you'll have me back sometime, because I feel like there's a whole other conversation about how we manage, how we show up and be human beings and the real life parts of this job and how we decide when we just need to kind of shove that down a little bit and show up and get the job down. And when we say, you know, I need to back off and take care of myself and my family. There's so much complexity to that. And there's so little conversation. And I appreciated how it's so powerful how you've shared about that.
Thank you. Yeah. And that thing of just the real life parts and what role the job plays. And just, again, we could talk for ages about the systemic pressures that make it seem like the job is everything. And that's our identity so wrapped up in it. It would be great to have a follow-up conversation. But I just want to thank you so much for this conversation today and all that you've shared, and that you did move from your book outline to the book, because it is a book that I've already started recommending to people. I think it's just full of so many good discussions and also practical sections at the end that where you invite people to really take some actions, and it's brilliant. So thank you for writing that.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for this conversation, and thanks for all the change you're creating through the podcast. This is what our field needs, and all the early career folks out there are counting on us to get this right. And I'm grateful for all you're doing, and thanks for the opportunity to join you.
Thank you.
You can find the summary notes, a transcript, and related links for this podcast on www.changingacademiclife.com. You can also subscribe to Changing Academic Life on iTunes, Spotify, and I'm really hoping that we can widen the conversation about how we can do academia differently. And you can contribute to this by rating the podcast and also giving feedback. And if something connected with you, please consider sharing this podcast with your colleagues. Together, we can make change happen.